This is Alice O. Howell on 29 May 1990, Jungian Synchronicity in Astrological Signs and Ages.
Okay, good evening. You can hear me. All right. Welcome, everyone. I'm Lisa Hazelwood. I'm involved with the program committee, and I'm pleased to be able to announce Ms. Howell's lecture tonight and to welcome her and to welcome you all. The C.G. Jung Society of Seattle is very pleased to welcome Alice Howell here tonight. We're very fortunate to have her as she is visiting here from her home in Massachusetts. So she's come a long way to be with us tonight, and we're just very, very fortunate to have this very delightful lady. I was lucky enough to have a couple of phone conversations with her, and each conversation was a delight, and I got off the phone feeling just wonderful after having talked with you. So that was good. Alice O. Howell has been a faculty member of the C.G. Jung Institutes in both Los Angeles and Chicago. And she truly is a pioneer in integrating astrology and psychology, particularly Jungian psychology. And we're very fortunate to have her address some of those topics tonight. We've asked her to speak regarding her new book, regarding issues that she brings in her new book, which came out about 6 weeks ago. And you'll find it available out in front. It's called Jungian Synchronicity and Astrological Signs and Ages. This is her fourth book. And among other topics that she discusses in the book are the topic of synchronicity between the past five astrological ages and the development of human consciousness. So this is a pretty big topic for us to take on, but I'm sure you'll be able to shed quite a bit of light on that for us tonight. And so, I welcome Alice O. Howell.
Thank you for having me. Our first thing I want to do is to ask how many of you know more about Jung than astrology? Would you hold up your hands? Uh-huh. And how many of you know more about astrology than Jung? This is my fate. Ah, well, we'll do our best. I think anyone who is involved with either Jung or astrology will know for sure one thing. You can learn about neither of them from the neck up. It has to be done with the whole being, the whole person. Now, I didn't know what kind of a place I was going to be talking in, and normally what I'd like to do is to make a circle, because it'll prove a point. I like to prove points in the simplest way possible, without a lot of words. So we'll have to use active imagination. I'm going to ask you to humor me and everybody hold hands. And I will tell you three reasons why, because this will prove the point. Were we in a circle, it would be very obvious. Now, you're left out. Come on. We can't have that. And what about me? Am I that leashed? Can I... Whoa. Okay. The reason is this. Just join and hold hands with somebody. The reason is this. If you can picture to yourself where you are sitting, obviously there will be people to the left and the right or in front or in back of you. Both astrology and Jung, or Jung and astrology, would agree with Heraclitus. Heraclitus was a pre-Socratic philosopher. And he said that with our eyes open, we share the same world. You have to hold hands. Very important. But when you close your eyes, each of us enters a private world. So open your eyes and close them. Now, when we enter the private world, and were we in a circle, or wherever we are, our gift to the collective is the viewpoint from the place where we sit or stand. Is that clear, even though we're not in a circle? Because no matter where you're sitting, you're going to see something just a little bit different. That's one reason. The second reason is scientific. And that is a professor at Stanford called William Tiller found through biofeedback. Do you know what biofeedback is? I imagine everybody on the West Coast knows biofeedback. Well, when you get two people holding hands, the energy is squared. So if you have this many people holding hands, either the building will levitate or something really good will happen because the energy is squared. And there's a word for this. I'd like to say I coined it, but I've certainly borrowed it from mathematics. It's called syntropy. Entropy is where everything kind of, you know, winds down. But syntropy revs up. And when you want to get to archetypal levels, you have to get revved up. Hear that now? We're going to get revved up. Hurry up! It has to work. You see, it's sort of magical. Okay? Hold hands. Okay. So just imagine that the energy in this room is squared by the number of people that are here. And the final thing, and you can ponder about this later on, because it suggests that in terms of the new Aquarian age, which I will explain to you hopefully a little bit later, that this kind of brotherhood, this caring and holding hands, is an alternate, because we don't know. Jesus said, when two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I also, so that this energy is increased. Another handhold. So that's a nice thought. And finally, the last thing that I wanted to share with is the fact that no matter whoever speaks to you or lectures or anything, it's never what the person says, but what you hear that will count. So those are three good reasons to hold hands. Thank you very much. So, now, the prospectus says that I'm supposed to cover 12,000 years in 30 minutes. It's going to be a rough ride. What is it Betty Davis says? Hang on to your seats. It's going to be a rough ride. I think I'd like to give you a few definitions before we start, because it's awful to get started and start talking about something that doesn't make any sense. My definition of astrology, for what it's worth, is that it is a language of archetypal processes. It's a symbolic language of archetypal processes. And Dane Rudyard gave a good definition. He called it an algebra of life. Astrology, whether you like it or not, or whatever anybody says about it, is as built into the cosmic system as mathematics or geometry. You can deny it, you can do whatever you like, but it's there. And so it's there for human beings to become more conscious of it and to raise it up perhaps to another level, which is certainly what Jung did. And Jung said a wonderful thing, which I quote in my most recent book. He said, our psyche is set up in accord with the structure of the universe, and what happens in the macrocosm likewise happens in the infinitesimal and most subjective reaches of the psyche. And, of course, I can't go into great detail tonight as to the logic of why it should work, but perhaps the best concept that we can come up with is that the solar system is like a gigantic cell, so that whatever happens within it happens to everybody and everything in it. And so that whatever partakes of any given moment of time, which is what how Jung described synchronicity, we partake of it at the same time. One of the traps of thinking about medieval astrology, let's put it, is this business of cause and effect. And what Jung has come up with is an explanation that means a lot to astrologers, because we get away from this A causes B and find that it's A and A prime that are working together at one and the same time. Jung defines synchronicity as an acausal kind of time, a time that is without cause and effect, and where outer events and inner meaning coincide. And I, again, to save time, I have found a little diagram that I find helpful. I'm going to put this is Woodstock. I'll put Woodstock over here. That's my portable piece of Scotland. When you went to school, you probably learned about a timeline. Do you remember that? Well, if you take a lifetime and you start out with birth, and then say about 12 years later, something interesting happens, what do we call that? Puberty. And then that enables us to enjoy something even more exciting called sex and reproduction. And then there's a long kind of a time where various other things happen. And finally, we kick the bucket. And that's supposed to be the end. Now, of course, it isn't. In ancient times, and even in the present, at these various rites of passage, the gods were called in. And there were religious ceremonies. In Christianity and in Judaism, we have ceremonies for both of these, let's say a christening or a birth or a bar mitzvah or a confirmation, a wedding, and a funeral. Now, that seems kind of a shame that we only do that on these big occasions. Actually, this could happen at any time. Now, to live a life from an astrological point of view that is just going in this direction would be the equivalent in Jungian terms to living a life identified with the ego. And I always say that if you wonder what it is to be identified with the ego, it's when you get up in the morning and say, life is just one damn thing after another. Then you know. And, you know, you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you went to school, you got through college, you got married, you had the kids, you bought a big house, you have a two-car garage, and where I live, you move to Florida, and you play shuffleball, and booms, that's it. And that's sad. So, Jung made it very clear, and in astrological terms, you noticed I put the moon here. At any time, we can pull in this vertical invitation, as it were. I'm going to put the sun up here. I'm getting to synchronicity. When you call in what Jung called the self, the Hindus call the Atman, and I choose to call the divine guest, something wonderful happens. And this is what Jung talked about in terms of the conjunctio of the gold and the silver, or the self, which at this point is projected out there, and the ego. And when the ego finally surrenders and begins to move towards the idea of a self, then we get an invisible circle. Can you see this invisible circle? How would you prove that it's there? See? See, the circle, I should have said this before, the circle is what Jung called the mandala, and you look at it and you think you know its area, right? It's obvious, but do you? What's the formula? Pi r squared, and pi never comes out. So this is a mystery. So the chart is a mystery, the cosmos is a mystery, and this comes as close to a symbol for the mystery of God, the meaning of life, whatever. So when you bring these two together, the conjunctio suggests an invisible circle. And how would you prove that it's there? Go back to sixth grade. What would you have to add up? Loud. That's right. 90, 90, 90, 90 makes 360. And of course, this circle is invisible. And so when these two come together in the conjunctio, incarnation takes place. But in another way, we can say that this is a symbol for synchronicity. Because Jung, in terms of time, speaks of illud tempus. Jungians, have you noticed that whenever, how important it is when Jung speaks Latin or quotes Latin, I've decided the self speaks Latin. Yeah. Because he calls it illud tempus. That time. And all the fairy tales start out once upon a time. So synchronicity is once upon a time. And once upon a time is now. And so in terms of time, this is the right time. And when this happens, usually it happens when we're under stress or we're very much excited, or what is it Maslow called, a peak experience. That's when you're most likely to encounter synchronicity. Now, an astrologer works with this all the time because the chart, when you start talking about the chart, the things and the images coming out of the chart match the experiences of the person. And so you enter the kingdom of synchronicity. So the psyche, the inner part of the psyche, is the place of synchronicity. And in terms of space, just before I erase this, this represents what Jung, here he speaks Greek, which might be more important, I don't know. Temenos, a sacred precinct, which is what the psyche is. So keeping this in mind you, I'm going fast because we're going to get to 12,000 years of history. So I wanted to get this basis of an understanding of what Jung meant by synchronicity, that when the outer and the inner coincide, he had another word for it. The alchemists call this the unus what? The unus mundus. The one world, the universe. In other words, it's as if there is another reality hidden behind what we call every day. And the ego is the one who works so hard to deal with what's going on day by day. But in the meantime, another part of us, namely the self or that mystery which is the center and totality of the psyche, is all the time living in the unus mundus. Now, can you see that if when the ego gets in touch with the self, it also gets in touch, even briefly, with that reality? So far, so good? I find that these diagrams save many, many words. You read them with the right brain. Saves time. mistake. Fix it any way you like. Is that better? Well, with that brief introduction to astrology and to synchronicity, we can maybe start in with the precession of the equinoxes. Now, because of a lack of time, I am going to beg you to write down, if you're taking notes, precession of the equinoxes. And you can look it up in an encyclopedia, or you can see a fairly intelligent, I mean, it was supervised, description of it in here with diagrams. But it has to do with what happens at the moment of spring. The Earth has a wobble in its axis, and because of that, the moment of spring falls short in terms of the outer constellations. I also have to add that there are two zodiacs. This will clarify or mystify. The one is visible, and the one I'm going to talk about now is the visible one, the ring of the constellations. The zodiac the astrology uses is the tropical zodiac, which is the apparent path of the sun. And this is invisible and turns at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. Within the visible sidereal zodiac of the constellations. It's complicated. On the other hand, Ezekiel seemed to have a notion of it. But for the sake of argument, imagine that at the moment of spring, which is when the sun appears to cross the celestial equator or the hula hoop of the earth, imagine a bell goes off. First moment of spring. And you were to take the earth and the sun and draw a straight line way, way, way out to the constellations. This point here would be called the point of the vernal equinox. And where that point hits in this great circle of the constellations is what determines the age that we're in. And right now, we are in the interface between the age of Pisces and the new age of Aquarius. And that means that from the last visible star in the constellation of Pisces to the first visible star, there is a space. And at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years, we're slowly moving. We are in the dawn, we are in the beginning, the interface. And so next time somebody asks you, I've read even that some people are sick to death of hearing about the New Age. It's passé. Well, I got news for you. We got 2,000 years of it yet to come. You better be patient. But this is the first time in history, as far as we know, that this many people have been conscious of entering a New Age. If you read the New Testament carefully, you will see that it's possible that St. Paul, he speaks of a new aeon. It's possible that he knew and that certain people, educated people at that time, did know, because this phenomenon was discovered by an astronomer called Hipparchus, a Greek who lived in Alexandria about 200 B.C., and who must have been brilliant. I mean, to figure this out with his head, with no instruments, as far as we know, is just incredible. But he was able to, he not only did that, he also came up with the invention of lines of latitude and longitude. So they knew the Earth was round back then. It took the Dark Ages for people to forget. So it seemed to me, as a history teacher, that there might be a connection and that it would be worthwhile looking into past ages. Well, of course, Jung was there way before, And if you read in Aeon, he devotes a whole chapter to the age of Pisces, which is the age that we're just moving out of. But if you have the patience to investigate, if you have a love of history and a love of mythology and an interest in Jung's theory of the collective unconscious and some knowledge of astrology, those four things come together in this evolution of the collective unconscious. And I like to start with the age of Cancer, simply because it is the age that is contiguous to history. The age of Cancer is prehistoric. And however, there are enough artifacts going back to the age, let's say, of 9,000 BC. And these ages, by the way, all have interfaces. And it's as if, how shall I say, nobody blows a whistle and says, today is the day. It's more like a wave in the ocean. It just begins, crests, and you find that the shift, the paradigm shift, a shift occurs all around the world in history. Something does happen. But it may not happen all on the same day. It may take 300 or 400 or 500 years. So you have to be very flexible in your mind. It's the sequence that matters. But the artifacts suggest between the ages of, let's say, 8500 BC and 6000 BC, that this certainly was the age of the Great Mother. All the artifacts point to that. And I'm going to try and put on the board the evolution of consciousness here. And the age over here. Now, the age of Cancer. Cancer is a sign that is ruled by the moon. And astrologers, and probably Jungians too, know that the moon and the mother are very often connected. And the opposite constellation is Capricorn. And archaeological digs have shown that during this period, and it's a period that Joseph Campbell writes brilliantly about in The Masks of God, Primitive Mythology, and also in his new works, you know, those big prehistoric, history of prehistoric man. There's every suggestion that during this age, not only was the mother worshipped, but the concept of death was there. And this is the period when the dead were kind of bound up and put back into the earth in the, a fetal position and covered with red ochre, and with obviously some ceremony. And all through the Near East, and now they're finding in the Mediterranean, all the artifacts point to the mother. Sometimes she's shown sitting on a throne of lions, which is interesting, or cats, because that suggests a hearkening back maybe to the age of Leo. But she's not holding a child. That's just basically a mother. She's a mother figure, and some of the things that Joseph Campbell showed, they have animals. She's got animals all over her, carved in her body and so forth, indicating that she's almost the earth mother. And if you think what mothers do, the process, remember I said astrology is a language of process, the process that of motherhood is really to give form to life. And so it would seem as if the collective unconscious at that point was involved in recognizing the fact that the feminine, the function of the feminine, was to give form to life. And there were indications, Leonard Woolley and various other historians or anthropologists have decided that at that period, men really didn't understand quite what their function was in reproduction. I think they were having a good time, but they might not have understood until the domestication of animals and so forth, they began to understand how reproduction took place. So in terms of consciousness, this would correspond with the Ouroboric phase. Now, the Ouroboros is the serpent biting its own tail. And Neumann, I should read you, well, Neumann's quote is full of very long words, so it would take too long probably to read it. But the idea he had was that the fetus goes through this kind of history of evolution physically, doesn't it? You know, at one point you don't know if it's a horse or a fish or a dolphin, or and that the differentiation making a human fetus takes quite a while in the womb. And he made a very bold suggestion, and that was that the psyche continues this. And that the psyche of every child and every one of us goes through these same phases slowly, recapitulating the whole history of mankind. And I'm watching my grandchildren carefully to see what age they're at. But the Ouroboric phase, when we get to the age of Cancer, from the age of Cancer to the age of Gemini, is when consciousness begins to dawn. And I think when you watch a little baby, you see it focus and it tries, and all of a sudden it's back out to lunch. Do you know what I mean? It just kind of goes glazed inward again, and then it tries and struggles a little more. And I think some of us go out to lunch. I know I do. It's kind of almost a regression into that Ouroboric phase. So, moving along, if we get to the age of Gemini, which is ruled, that's the other constellation. What rules Gemini, astrologers? Mercury, right. So, I don't have room here for Mercury. Mercury is in the body, rules the brain, two lobes, the tongue, the fingers, and the process of communicating. So, it would seem that between the ages of 6 and 4,000 BC, give or take 500 years on both sides, that human beings collectively began to come into a kind of consciousness that they hadn't had before. And the artifacts change, because now the mother is either holding a child or a bird. And the bird is, strangely enough, ruled by Gemini, and is also a symbol for consciousness. So that this is kind of the dawning of consciousness itself. And Campbell puts out the idea that before this, people were not unlike bees and ants. They moved. There would be a leader, but they would kind of move harmony with one another, but without too much awareness of what was going on. One of the great mysteries, you know, the tombs at Ur, where they found these collective burials, 40 attendants lying without any sense of struggle, no indication of drugs. They just lay down to accompany their leader. And, of course, there isn't all that much until the end of the age of Gemini where we can prove any of this, except we can speculate. But the interesting thing is that Gemini, which rules the process of communication, also rules writing. And at the end of the age of Gemini, roughly speaking, 4000 BC, we get the first pictographs, ideographs, and the very, very beginnings of writing and communication. So consciousness and writing, communicating. And now we begin to get into history. I'm sorry I can't put more up here, but let's say this is roughly, it's all in the book, 6000 to 4000 BC. Then the next age, you'll notice that the constellation, the precession of the equinoxes moves backward through the constellations. We normally think Aries, Taurus, Gemini, right? But these go backwards. They go, so it's in the other direction. So it would seem as if the collective goes in that direction and the personal chart goes in this direction. It's quite interesting. Now, when we get to the age of Taurus, history is, well, now we're getting to where we're documented. What is the animal we associate with Taurus? The bull. And the bull was worshipped, and there's a whole chapter in there. I call it the celestial roundup, because the bull was worshipped in connection with agriculture in Egypt, in Assyria, in Crete, in Greece, in China, in India, and even in terms of sequence in Norse mythology, though that much of Norse mythology is not all that well known, except the sequence is there. You get the creation myth of the Norse is, if I remember correctly, a cosmic cow licked the first man out of the ice. Must have been the first cow lick. You know, that's why we have cow licks, because the cow was... But why the bull? And even Campbell at one point says, why the bull? That was before he kind of knew about these ages. But the bull in astrology is connected to agriculture and to property. And nowadays in astrology, you'd say banking and real estate and things of this kind. That is the sign. Now, the bull was everywhere worshipped. And this would have been about 4,000 B.C. to roughly 1800 B.C. Now, the sign of astrology, of the sign of Taurus in astrology, has to do with having, with owning. And 4000 BC was roughly the time of the first civilizations, by that, real cities. And to have real cities, you had to have enough protein and starch to feed the people in the cities. And you couldn't have a city without agriculture. Now, agriculture means settling down, planting the seed, and what do you think would happen next if you were an Egyptian farmer or an Assyrian or Sumerian, or you plant your seed, what would you do next? Most likely. Farmers, believe me, in Kansas and Oklahoma still do the same thing. Water. Well, they had no way. Well, they started irrigation around that time, to be sure. But what would psychologically the first thing they would do? Pray. You bet. Pray for water. Pray for sunshine. Pray for no locusts. Pray for no war. And the funny thing is that when you pray over something, the next thing that happens is you've invested psychic energy in whatever it is. When you've invested psychic energy, you begin to think you own it. There's a strange, interesting sequence there. And so this is the first time in history that nationalism comes up. And the idea of fighting for property, not for game or for... And so this argument, you know, between the cowboys and the farmers begins with this big duality as to who is going to be a nomad and who is going to settle down and raise crops. And it's so interesting because if you who are familiar with Jung, if you go and study what the sign of Taurus rules, you will see the most incredible things. The name, the word, capitalism, comes from caput, meaning head. And a man's wealth was often reckoned in how many heads of steer or heads of cattle that he had. And chattel is another word. His possessions, chattel and cattle, are cognate, and they both are the origin of the word capitalism. Well, think of the stock market. And think of being bullish. You never get bored if you're an astrologer, believe me. And, you know, did you get the ads for Merrill Lynch? Do you get them out here with the bull walking through Wall Street? Well, I always wondered if the person who designed those knew what he was doing. And would you believe it, I got a client who made the films, who did the filming of those, and I asked him. I said, did they know? No, hadn't a clue. So this connection, you see, of the bull with owning and ownership and so forth was a huge development at the age of Taurus. Scorpio, which is the opposite constellation, see, each one of these resonates across the way, is the sign that is associated with sex, birth, and death. And it's during this period that you get the first myths of resurrection. And you can see how in planting the seed, and the seed comes up and gets cut down and so forth and so on, that these cyclical myths began to emerge. And they're very elaborate, and you can check them all out. They're fascinating. And when I was writing the book, my publisher, I don't know quite how to put it. They were very idealistic, and I don't think they wanted too much below the waist. In ancient Egypt, a lot went on below the waist. And when they would put one of these sacred bulls, women would come and dance in a ritual and raise their skirts and expose their private parts to the bull. I don't know what he thought of it all, but it made the crops grow. And you know, we think so often, and this used to bother me as a student when I loved ancient history, obviously, but they. Far, because it might let on to men that women really were brighter than men, or, you know, it's being facetious, which is absurd. But the New Age, you see it in unisex already, the fact that, well, yesterday at the park, we saw a young man and a young woman from the back, both with long curly hair, holding hands, going down, and except for her ankles, I wouldn't have known which was which. And that's a sign of the times. So the feminine is, and also the change in our attitude towards ecology and towards Mother Earth, to the idea of Earth Day, all these signs are of beginning to care. And I think the icon of the Age of Aquarius is the picture of the Earth from the moon. If that wasn't a switch, what is there? That is our precious planet. We must love it, cherish it, and see it as holy. See, the split between spirit and matter has done a terrible thing. You got me going. When you got the Trinity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, Hagia Sophia was the Holy Ghost. They translated it Spiritus Sanctus. The endings of those words are masculine. So little by little, the referring pronouns became masculine. The whole Trinity became masculine, and the feminine was left out of the Godhead. And what that did to women and to nature is what we have been suffering from. And it didn't have to happen, perhaps, except history is strange. But now the dove, and it's Jung who has led. This is what this book is all about. That the dove in the stone, which is an alchemical reference, is those drops of light, the consciousness that may indeed be in matter and in our everyday life, and that the fact that what we need is all around us. It just requires a loving eye, another way of looking at things. But that's a whole other thing. And any other question? Yes.
Do you foresee another age after the age of Aquarius, and what might be the task or the performance in that?
Well, that you're asking me to go about 2,500 years from now, so your guess is as good as mine. Let's hope we get through the Age of Aquarius. And no, I can't answer that, because it depends on how well we do with the Age of... Of course, the Age of Capricorn is... And that's an Earth sign. Well, maybe by then we will have prized our Earth. I trust. Yes. Have I spent time in a seminary?
In Istanbul.
Oh, Istanbul, yes.
And how did the image of Sophia first speak?
Well, it first started with a lot of synchronicities in my life having to do with doves. And I went to a book of symbols and began looking up the word dove and what it symbolized. Then, as I was writing Jungian Symbolism, the first book, I did a lot of research going through the works of Jung in order to find the quotations that I needed and so forth. And as I went along, I kept finding these wonderful references to the dove. And there are quotations throughout this book, but I'd have to look for them, there's no index, from Jung, in which he quotes the alchemists, and he quotes saying that the only clue left that the Holy Ghost is feminine is the dove, because the dove was sacred to the goddess. And throughout, he speaks of the dove. And then, if you think of Kundalini and the caduceus of Mercury, that the dove is at the top of the caduceus, that's another clue. So the dove is a symbol of the feminine. And in the back of this book, there's a chapter called Bringing the Dove Home. And in it, I give an account of the incredible synchronicities that occurred while I was writing this book. To the point, even, I'll give you one. I had a secretary who was helping me because I got so many letters from the first book. So I had dictated two letters about the dove and the feminine and so forth, and what it symbolized. And my secretary, whose name is Nikki, said, oh, if only more women knew that they don't have to be angry, that they can just be, you know, and what a good news it would be that this new old archetype might come back for. And we're discussing this, and I'm driving her home. This is in Monterey, Massachusetts, and we go down New Marlborough Road, which is a little bumpy road. And as we are driving, I'm driving the car, on the road is a white dove walking. Boom, 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 boom. Turns around, not flying, walking. Turns around, boom, boom, boom. I roll down the window, boom, 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 boom. And it looks up at me, and I look down at it. And we cling to each other and goosebumps. These things happened. And then after I'd written the book, I came across two books, one way or another, about Iona, where there had been predictions that news of the Holy Spirit being feminine would come from the Isle of Iona. And Iona means, this is in Scotland, and St. Columba means dove. Iona, the people of the island say, how funny, because Yona in Hebrew means dove. And he came and landed with his disciples on the eve of Pentecost, when the doves descended, as it were, on the... I mean, there's so many synchronicities, it's unbelievable. And now I get letters from people, they read the book and they start seeing doves. So, the dove is abroad, that's all I can say. It's fun! It really is. Yes? That's a very good question, and I have to respond to that by my ignorance. I never have studied, you know, Aztec and Mayan and so forth. It's the sequence that counts in terms, but I just honestly can't speak to it because I haven't studied it. And I'm ashamed that I haven't, but I grew up in Europe, so I got all this other stuff. The other thing about Hagia Sophia, Jung points out that when some archetype is rejected, it hides out. And it hides out usually in fairy tales. Now, where do you think you would find Hagia Sophia in a fairy tale? Who is it that's feminine, that mediates between heroes and heroines, always giving them practical advice? No. Only in disguise. What? The fairy godmother. The fairy godmother. And the fairy godmother is really Sophia in disguise. And you see, fairy godmothers aren't scary. Hags are scary. The fairy godmothers are friendly. And fairy godmothers are something that every child wants to believe in so badly. And I grew up with one. Her name was Mercy Muchmore. And it's nice to think you can go back to believing in fairy godmothers, because the essence of Hagia Sophia is light. Not the wise old man with a long white beard, but a flirtatious, feminine, and she's described to perfection in the Old Testament. And Jung has all the appropriate quotes, and guess what? I copied them all out, and I put them in here. So, well, we did it. We did 12,000 years. So study Jung, and Jungians do look into astrology with a new eye, and I do hope that the astrologers will all be diligent in looking into Jung, because it can open up a whole new way of seeing the chart as a description of the way a person processes experience. That's it. Well, bull with owning and ownership and so forth was a huge development at the age of Taurus. Scorpio, which is the opposite constellation, see, each one of these resonates across the way, is the sign that is associated with sex, birth, and death. And it's during this period that you get the first myths of resurrection. And you can see how in planting the seed, and the seed comes up and gets cut down and so forth and so on, that these cyclical myths began to emerge. And they're very elaborate, and you can check them all out. They're fascinating. And when I was writing the book, my publisher, I don't know quite how to put it. They were very idealistic, and I don't think they wanted too much below the waist. In ancient Egypt, a lot went on below the waist. And when they would put one of these sacred bulls, women would come and dance in a ritual and raise their skirts and expose their private parts to the bull. I don't know what he thought of it all, but it made the crops grow. And you know, we think so often, and this used to bother me as a student when I loved ancient history, obviously, but they left out all this good stuff, interesting stuff. And of course, they couldn't make these connections. And so when I was growing up, I'm 67, and when I was growing up, there was a tendency to kind of downplay myths as being ridiculous. I mean, really? You know, to think that people were so stupid to do things like that and worship a bull. But nobody understood the symbolism. What was it they really were? And this is where astrology opens the key. And so to all of those of you here who are not particularly interested in becoming astrologers in order to read charts, study astrology in order to understand the key to this language of symbolism, of these archetypal processes. You will never regret it. It opens the key to so many, many things. Now, in terms of the collective, you have here then the issues of possession and of resurrection. Very important. And in the development of humanity, or the collective unconscious, there was this first beginning of having. And in the development of a child, you may notice that little two-year-olds or one-and-a-half-year-olds, they're getting brighter every year, very often speak of themselves in the third person. And it's the first beginnings of identifying with themselves is to say, it's mine. Mine, mine. My grandchildren said, moine, moine. And there's a tug of war, so that this idea of having comes almost before the word I. You know, Jimmy wants breakfast, but not I want breakfast. So having is a big step towards becoming an individual. Gosh, there's so much that could be said, but moving right along. When 1800 BC, give or take, came, bulls were out and rams were in. And this is a fact. If you look in your ancient history books, you'll never look at them the same way again. I mean, I never look at the illustrations in any of these books, but what I look to see, ha-ha, there's another one. You get the age of Aries. Libra. And this goes from 1800 BC to approximately, give or take, remember, 4 BC, the birth of Christ. Now, what is obviously happening is the synchronicity of development, and it suggests either we have to be so awestruck that there is a plan, and that for the first time we're entering an age knowing that there is a plan. To be facetious, because it is so awesome, it's like saying, yes, Virginia, there is a menu. There is a design, and every single one of these ages, which I apologize, and I'm sure you understand, that 12,000 years of history in 30 minutes is difficult. But I just want to give you the idea, anyway, of how it goes. Up until now, the important people have all been rulers, kings, queens, pharaohs. You don't hear of any individuals until the age of Aries. And it's interesting in mythology that during the age of Aries, this is the first time in history you begin to hear the names of individuals, number one. And number two, it's the first time we encounter heroes who are mortal. They are not the sons and daughters of gods and goddesses, but they are mortal. And of course, one of the things they're best at is killing bulls. They become bull slayers. So in all these countries I've mentioned, there's a switch. And now the in thing to do is to destroy the bull and set up the ram. And in Egypt, you can even see jewelry that will have the bull's horns with the ram's horns coming out of them. I mean, it's amazing. What was Jason after? The Golden Fleece. And of course, the great religion of this period was Judaism and Moses. And what was Moses' cross about when he came down? They were worshiping the golden calf. They'd gone backsliding to the old-time religion. Bulls were out. Rams were in. And if you read, they knocked down the altars and they set up new altars with 12 stones, and there will be a ram's horn at the corner of every one of them. And of course, the Passover is involved with the blood of lambs, and today even the shofar, the ram's horn, is blown. So this other constellation opposite it, Libra, the scales, in the last 800 years BC, you get the first collective laws. And you have the Code of Hammurabi, you have the 12 tablets of Rome, you have the Ten Commandments, you have the Noble Eightfold Path and the Middle Way. What have I forgotten? There are more. But it was the first attempt to make laws equal and just for all the people in a given area. It was a huge step. Now, Libra, the sign, which is ruled by Venus, Mars, incidentally, rules Aries, also rules art. And if you stop to think about it, during this period, the Golden Age of Greece, if things are fair, that word in English has two meanings. They're just and they're beautiful. And so just relationships among people were important. And when a thing is just, it will be in proportion. If it's in proportion, it will be harmonious. If it's in harmonious, it will be beautiful. And so little by little, the glory that was Greece and the explosion of art. Now, this is one of the most creative periods in history that we can even think of. And in terms of the development of humanity, it is the birth of the collective ego. And the word ego in Latin means what? I. Yahweh means what? I am that I am. And it's really amazing how many gods, kings, and important people have that sound. This is the time of Rama, Abraham. If you remember, Abraham was first Abram, then he became Abraham, Ramesses. And in a kind of funny way, what is R-A-M-S backwards, as it were, or R-A-M? It's Mars. And so in the Peloponnesian War, Sparta was all Ares, Athens was all Libra, and that conflict was brought out. So in history, you have to admit that by the time, let's say, 300 BC, 200 BC, there's an explosion of inventions, scientists, drama, art, and names. Names, names, names of individuals. They're not just kings, they're writers, they're artists, they're generals, they're... And of course, astrology, which I haven't mentioned, has also evolved so that we get, for the first time, the charts of individuals, not just rulers. L'état, c'est moi, as it were. So this was an enormous step. And from here, a shift occurs from a theocentric world to an anthropocentric world. And man, and led particularly by Judaism, I think most people agree that one of the great steps of Judaism was the separation of man from God and a covenant, and a separation of man and nature and a covenant. Now, this is also the period, ladies, when the mother goddess had problems, because men suddenly discovered what they were capable of, and they weren't going in for any of this mysterious banshee wailing and whatnot, and chthonic goddesses. And so this is the period at Delphi when Apollo slays the serpent. And from now on, for a long period of time, there is a rise of consciousness, of masculine logos energy. And many of the religions switch. In the good old days, a decent woman had to go and give herself for the goddess at the temple of love to a stranger. And there was a big switch when men began to see that they had property they wanted their children to inherit, so adultery became punishable by death. So there's a huge shift in consciousness from the feminine, unconscious, to the conscious and the masculine. And some religions, like Zoroastrianism and so forth, women weren't even allowed to join. So this was another huge shift. And I think in Jungian terms, we could say it was the rise of the logos, of the word. And we haven't quite recovered from that. And in terms of the evolution of a human being, as you know, we all have to develop a strong ego. And the sad thing is, once you've got it, then you're told you've got to give it up. But you can't give up what you haven't got. So you've got to have it before you can do the next thing. And that's also in the menu. I will go one more, and then we'll take a break. So here we have all these symbols of the ram. The rams at Karnak, the rams on the coins of Athena. She has ram's horns. The Gundestrup cauldron has a serpent, and there's a ram's head. You start looking in your history books now, look at the pictures and see where the rams are. Can you think of any other ram myths? There are quite a few of them. Well, I better not stop. We've got the ego, right? Everybody's got an ego. And everybody, of course, the minute you've got an ego, the next thing you find out is somebody else has one too. And that's very upsetting. And so you can see why laws had to come with the development of the ego. You had to have rules and regulations where you would respect. And the Chinese were the ones who really got off onto, and the Hindus, onto the proper relationships between a man and his friend, a man and his wife, a parent and child, a master and so forth. All this was codified so that there would be courtesy and kind of etiquette of bowing and scraping and being polite to the other person's ego. And you can see a lot of this going on in kindergarten. Because the ego has to be there, and it's painful. So, moving right along, is this interesting? Does it make sense? I mean, really, it's amazing. When we get to the age of Pisces, the lamb is slain. The slain lamb. And, of course, the Virgo. And each one of these ages has a dialectic. See, these oppositions form dialectics. And the dialectic of this age that we're just moving out of is faith and reason. And from, let's say, 4 BC until just recently, and you can take your pick, I have my favorite time for thinking the dawning of the New Age came, and I'll tell it to you after break. The lamb is slain, and the new symbols are fish. The symbol of Christianity is the fish. I will make you fishers of men. And Virgo is the sign of the Virgin. And the characteristics of the sign Pisces are of agape, of surrender, of sweetness, of martyrdom, of withdrawal from the world, of meditation, of kindness, of sympathy. And the opposite sign, Virgo, is the one of analysis and of reason. And you can see how in the last 2,000 years the tremendous arguments between faith and reason, between science and so forth. And the sad thing is that astrology, which up until now had been uniting all of these things, suddenly gets rejected by both. So science rejected astrology around the age of reason, Descartes and so forth, and religion rejected astrology because it gave too much power to the people. It was also considered superstitious and basically not healthy for an individual to know that much. And I think that when that split occurred, that in a way, religion lost its proof and science lost its sense of the sacred. And we have suffered a lot. I mean, we really need to bring these two together. And Jung was one of the great saviors, if you will, of astrology, putting it on another level of understanding. I mean, he wasn't the only one, to be sure, but he did more, actually, for alchemy than for astrology. But he didn't let the stone of astrology, he didn't leave it unturned. He did turn it over and did investigate it and had great respect for it and raised it up again. So the message of this age, and one that we have not quite learned, is the surrender. I hate the word ego death. I don't like that because we all have to have an ego, but the ego needs to surrender itself to what? The inner, yes, to the inner self. To the inner self or the divine guest. And the good news is that this is the task of the future. And it's probably one of the reasons every single one of you is in this room, because you will be involved in one way or another helping people to at least accept the idea that such a thing could be. Because can you see that here, when we are identified with the ego, the self has to be projected out. So it's projected out onto a god up there, out there, the sun, or whatever it is. The last place you'd look for it would be inside yourself. And so this is a 180-degree shift. And it was tried by the Gnostics, and it ran afoul because a few people then became identified with the self, which causes a huge inflation and is very perilous. The worst example of that we would know would be Jim Jones, right, where identification with the self was there and the surrender wasn't there, because the self is not who we think we are. It is the divine guest in us that is incarnating in us. And so it is paradoxical. You could say, yes, it is partly me, but it is, I cannot say that I am it. Did you understand what I'm saying? It's very tricky. So it's so tricky that I think we should take a break. And then we will confront briefly the age to come. I think we did pretty well, don't you? I think I probably better take this thing off. How do I do that?
And Virgo is like an instrument, and to get it right, it's to be the instrument of the divine?
Every sign is to be the instrument of the divine, one way or the other. I don't know how to do this. I'm scared. I might wreck it.
I'll wait till after.
Yeah, don't. There's a hook here somewhere.
On a leash.
There's always a way.
All right. We're ready to begin again. I just have a mention for you that Alice Howe will be giving a workshop this coming weekend in Portland. It's not that far away. She'll be giving a workshop for the Friends of Jung in the Oregon Friends of Jung in Portland. And the workshop will be on the Dove and the Stone. That'll be all day on Saturday. And you're giving a lecture on Friday night as well, is it? Okay, basically the same lecture on Friday night, but time for questions and so on, and then a workshop all day on Saturday. So, let me turn it over to you then.
Well, moving right along, as they say.
Yes. Okay.
This brings us to the age of Aquarius, and there are as many theories as to when that did not, will, or whatever, as there are astrologers or scientists or whatever. So I'm just going to give you my version. How's that? I choose arbitrarily the dawning, the first glimmers of the new age, as occurring the end of the 18th century with the discovery of the planet Uranus. And the age of Aquarius is ruled by the planet Uranus. It's an air sign, never mind the water bearer. Those little zigzags are prana. They're invisible waves or vibrations of energy, however you want to interpret that, X-ray or radio or... But that's what they are. They're not water. They're the water of life. And the age of Aquarius is the sign rules things that have a lot to do with the cry of the French Revolution. There were three revolutions at that time, and Uranus is associated with revolutions. Of course, they were the American, the French, and who can think of a third? A little sneaky. The Industrial Revolution, absolutely, which freed us so that I can stand here instead of over a washtub, and ladies here, you can be sitting here, and so forth, because thanks to all those Uranian inventions, we have been liberated. It's the age of the common man, the age of brotherhood. The cry of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité. Liberty, brotherhood, and equality. These are all Aquarian watchwords. And Uranus was discovered by a common man. He was an amateur astronomer. Now, if you think what that would mean. He was a German musician called Herschel, and he played in a band in Bath, England. And he polished his own lenses, and he sat out in his backyard and looked through and said, "Ach du lieber, I do believe there is a new planet." And he called up the Royal Society, and they said, "By gum, I think he's right. None of this Galileo business." They looked through there, and they were so impressed, I don't know, he must have felt pretty pleased with himself, that they wanted to call the planet Herschel after him. And so then came the question of Jupiter and Saturn and Herschel. And even Herschel felt badly. He wanted to call it Georgius after the king, but that didn't sound too good either. So they hit on the god Uranus. And however, there is an astrologer, Tanis, who suggests that it probably should have been called Prometheus, because the nature of Uranus is much more Promethean than it is Uranian. But we're stuck with Uranus. In India, though, they still call it Herschel. And the H... The symbol for Uranus is kind of interesting. It looks... Can I erase up here? I think you must have taken whatever. The symbol is H, like this, for Herschel. And it rules Aquarius, the glyph of which is that. And if you look carefully on the top of people's houses, you'll see Herschel up there, TV antennas. It pays to be in astrology. You will never be bored, ever. So I think the age of Aquarius began to dawn, let's put it that way. Other people tell you won't be around until 2036 or who knows, but I mean, that's their idea, not mine. So the huge task, which I hinted at, that is ahead of us, is this discovering in the correct way of the divine guest within. Now, this is certainly not a new idea. The Hindus and the Buddhists and so forth have had it, and certainly the Christian mystics. The mystics of every religion have taught this. It's interesting, the mystics of every single religion all say the same thing. And the reason is they've experienced it. So they know what they're talking about. And I, again, to use a diagram, it's a good shortcut. Next to astrology, I think geometry is a wonderful aid. But if this is the psyche, and Jung defines the self as the center and the totality of this mystery, the area of which can never be known, can you see how the ego might be orbiting around and around, trying to make sense out of subways and bubble gum and Gorbachev and sauerkraut and... You know, it goes round and round. I mean, what is this world all about? The world of the 10,000 things. And, of course, after going round in circles and circles and circles, finally, either it comes to a crisis or despair and stops or goes to an analyst. and learns, or you certainly can do it through religion or the many different ways we come to it. But the beautiful thing about Jung is that Jung offers a description of quote-unquote the way, the methodology, in a way that unites in all the religions of the world who've been talking about this in their mystical way as the only way. And if you stop to think about it, if Krishna says, I am the way, and Jesus says, I am the way, in Western Aristotelian logic, one or the other is right, and the other one is wrong. But they're talking about a process, a method. There is only one method, and the method is the process by and through which the ego starts to look for the center, whatever you want to call that. It's a psychological truth. And maybe it's Jung and his ideas that are spreading around the world will help, because it can't be contaminated by a creed and morality and pointing the finger, which is what Virgo does best. I mean, that is the symbol of the shadow of the past age is you are wicked, you broke the law, you are naughty, you're going to hell, you know, whatever. Bad. That's Virgo, not Polly. Mrs. Grundy. So, here we have the ego. And suddenly the ego decides it's going to go on the path, the way. Now, to go to the center, what's another word for that in Latin? What do we do? What do many people do? Calm down and meditate. to meditate is to go to the center. Or somehow the first step is to convince a person that there is more to them than they thought. That there is a Christ within, an Atman, never mind the name, but a center. And that that center is a living force, a well of flame that is and is not who you are. And when that happens, when the ego decides to go on this trip, this would be what Jung would call the way to individuation. And Jung also said that individuation, theologically understood, is incarnation. And so whenever we go here and ask for help, help always comes. It always comes. But it takes an enormous amount of faith to believe that you or I might possibly have something within us that significant, let's put it that way, that would give meaning to life. Well, anyway, I don't know about your experience of going on the path, but whenever most people start going on the path, you expect a little bit angels to get out the trumpets and the red carpet, and here she comes, finally he's seen the light, he's coming, you know, and you wake up the next morning and you open up the door and there is a humongous pile of shit. Then you know you're on the path. It is the nigredo. It is the prima materia. It's the whole accumulation of your mistakes, your, you know, but there's gold in them, thy hills. And that's the alchemy, is to work on that process and never give up. Now, meanwhile, while you're working on the pile, it may take, I remember when I was in analysis, I said to my analyst how distressed I was. I felt I'd wasted 26 years of my life. And he said, just be glad it wasn't 26 lifetimes. End of comfort. So much for that. So anyway, this is the perilous path. And there are two times during every day that one is voluntary and one is involuntary, where we get a break. What would be the involuntary one? Louder. When we sleep, we get a break. And what would be the voluntary? Meditation. Because in meditation, somehow you can become a little more objective. And never mind if you say, well, I don't know how to meditate, my mind goes round in circles or whatever. You just sit down and let your mind go round in circles and observe it. And after you've done that for 2-3 weeks, you say, hey, who's observing? And then it gets easier. So this relationship of the ego is the task of the New Age. In other words, discovery of the inner self. And like this stage, it involves a recognition, because if you discover you have one, or believe you have one, it follows automatically that everyone you meet has one. It also might involve the idea that the world, the earth, and all in it has consciousness and therefore should be revered. And of course, the big secret might be that the sacred has been hidden all along in the commonplace. And the helper on this, and this is a whole other lecture, as it were, but the helper of the process to get from here to there is the aid of the third person of the Trinity, which was originally feminine. Hagia Sophia, holy wisdom. And Hagia Sophia is not solemn. She's young, she's pretty, she was the playmate of God, and she's kind and humorous and good and friendly to mankind. You can read about her in the Old Testament. Her name was Holy Wisdom, and her symbol is the dove. So the task ahead is the discovery of the inner self or the light within. And Sophia, according to the legend, was a playmate of God, and she hid in matter, in drops of light. And so the task of human beings is to become conscious and rediscover her. Isn't that a nice idea? So that would be one of our purposes, would be to rediscover and see the world in a whole new way. Now, the trap for this age would be too great, being too impersonal. And the cure is the opposite sign, Leo, which rules love. So you can see that we've tried all these different kinds of collective governments, communism, socialism, democracy, and all these different attempts to free the common man. But if it gets too theoretical and abstract, which is the trap of Aquarius, you forget the person who is right next to you. So I thought it'd be a nice way to end. And this is kind of also, if we were in a circle, it would make it easier. But see if you could give it a good Aquarian try. Hugs to the left and hugs to the right. Try it. Now that's Aquarius. Hugs to the left and hugs to the right. Woo! I'm trapped. Hug. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Good.
No, don't take it off yet.
Okay, you do this.
This is my dear husband, whom I get to hug every day, Walter Anderson. No, don't take it off. Now, I was told that we have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has a question, have it now. Yes. I see it everywhere. I don't think there's a man in the audience that hasn't seen the feminine coming back in. The very fact that women are able to get out of the house occasionally and go to seminars and begin to contribute intellectually, and you see, the ideal of the feminine for so long, whether no matter what your faith, the culture has had Mary as an ideal. And Mary was a human being who had the goddess projected onto her in many ways, which was a little bit unfair because she was human. And so, because the image of Mary, whom I revere greatly, was so sweet and so pure, no woman could possibly be that sweet and that pure, and nobody ever would inquire as to her IQ. You know, that would be threatening to the masculine. I'm not, mind you, I don't want to say anything offensive about the Mary, because she's a beautiful, beautiful image of the feminine. But the split was that it's almost as if Lucifer got all the brains and she got all the love. And you get a horrible shadow image in the Middle Ages of the worst thing possible for a woman was to shack up, right, with the devil. That was terrible. But yet the dark image of that is a portrait of what happens when you put the logos all on one side and the eros all on the other. Then there's a terrible split. And women have suffered from this split. You can also speak of the witch and the virgin. I mean, these are all different archetypal ways. But the feminine is coming back so strongly in the fact that men are feeling more secure in expressing their feelings, and women are feeling more secure in revealing the fact that they might have a little brain. It shouldn't be bragged about too much, because Walters was quoting something from the Reader's Digest or something that feminism is really shouldn't go too far, because it might let on to men that women really were brighter than men, or, you know, it's being facetious, which is absurd. But the New Age, you see it in unisex already, the fact that, well, yesterday at the park, we saw a young man and a young woman from the back, both with long curly hair, holding hands, going down, and except for her ankles, I wouldn't have known which was which. And that's a sign of the times. So the feminine is, and also the change in our attitude towards ecology and towards Mother Earth, to the idea of Earth Day, all these signs are of beginning to care. And I think the icon of the Age of Aquarius is the picture of the Earth from the moon. If that wasn't a switch, what is that? That is our precious planet.